Court is back in session.
Good morning, good afternoon. Go ahead and be seated. All right, next case we got on calendar today is 68523, MDC Restaurants LLC versus District Court. And I understand that there's an agreement to share time. What I've done is extended this argument to 20 minutes on each side rather than the regular 15, just to accommodate counsel. And so I assume you have your time allocated. Mr. Ross Kelly, are you ready? I believe you're going first.
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Rick Roscoe, attorney for Winners of Las Vegas, Cedar Enterprises, and Dryad's Restaurant Group. I will take approximately 14 minutes of the 20 minutes allotted to the consolidated appellants. Mr. Scott Davis of the Attorney General's Office will take the balance of the time, reserving something for rebuttal.
Right.
The issue that I will handle primarily is the question that is common to all of the consolidated matters on appeal here. And that is the question which was certified by the United States District Court for the District of Nevada for resolution by this court. That is, whether an employee must actually enroll in health benefits offered by an employer before the employer may pay that employee at the lower tier minimum wage under the minimum wage amendment. In other words, this court is called upon to decide the meaning of the phrase provides health benefits in the context of the minimum wage amendment. It is the position of the consolidated appellants that the phrase provides health benefits has its common everyday meaning to make available. Respondents, on the other hand, urge this court to adopt an excessively narrow definition of the phrase provides health benefits. According to respondents, a fee is not provided unless there is an affirmative act of acceptance or use by the party to whom it is made available. In other words,
is that consistent with most definitions that you've run across as to whether to offer or to enroll? As it pertains to provide?
No, provide and commonly has the same definition or similar definitions of offer. If you take a look at the definitions that we've, all the parties have talked about, whether it's a thesaurus or a dictionary, even a court case, they all agree that both terms mean, at the essence, to make available. There's not inherently a requirement that a party accept what is made available, what is provided, for that to be provided. And there are many examples of this. Take, for example, Clark County School District, which provides school buses to children who live a certain distance from a school. Now, the fact that a parent chooses to drive their child to school and not take the bus doesn't mean the bus wasn't provided. It means that the person decided not to take advantage of that bus which was provided, but the bus is provided nonetheless. The same thing is true here in this particular case. The term provide has a meaning which encompasses offer or to make available. In fact, if you take a look at the plain language of the minimum wage amendment, which is where I would like to start, it is clear that the meaning of the phrase health, provides health benefits. All we have to do is look to the second and third sentences of the amendment to ascertain what that term means, because it is only in those two sentences where the terms are discussed. None of the other sections, none of the other sentences of the minimum wage amendment talk about provides health benefits, health insurance, or health benefits.
Well, they didn't actually use the word provide. They indicated an employer must actually provide, supply, or furnish qualifying health benefits.
Well, that's what the district court said below. But what the minimum wage amendment said, if you take a look at the second sentence, which is the operative sentence here, it sets a two-thirds minimum wage, both tiers tied to the consumer price index urban. But what it says is that for the employer to pay the lower tier minimum, the employer may pay the lower tier minimum wage if, quote, if the employer provides health benefits as described herein. Now, construing the terms and the phrases of those harmoniously, we have to look at what is described herein mean. That tells us that the drafters of the amendment intended to describe what they meant by provides health benefits. When you canvass the entire minimum wage amendment, there's only one sentence that could possibly even define what they mean by provides health insurance or health benefits, and that is the first sentence. And the first sentence, and I'll quote it verbatim, states, offering health benefits within the meaning of this section shall consist of making health insurance available to the employees for the employee and the employee's dependents at a total cost to the employee for the premium of not more than 10% of the employee's gross taxable income from the employer. So what we have now is the first thing it's doing is telling us, okay, we just told you we're going to describe what it means to provide health benefits. Now we're telling you what it means. Offering health benefits, as described in this section, means making health insurance available. Making health insurance available to the employee, making health insurance available to the employee and the employee's dependents, and making health insurance available at a cost of not more than 10% of the employee's income. Clearly, when taking the in the context of the minimum wage amendment and giving due meaning to all the terms, the phrase provides health benefits means making health insurance available. This is supported by various definitions of the terms, which all have the common to make available. In other words, as I stated just a few seconds ago, the term provides does not necessarily entail an act of acceptance or any act on behalf of the party receiving the benefit. In fact, if we are...
But you say offer and provides for purposes of sentences 2 and 3 mean exactly the same thing.
They do. They're clearly referring back to each other.
And so what do you do with the presumption that words are used consistently throughout, and if they seem to be used in contradistinction to one another, there must be some inscrutable reason for that?
Well, what we do with that is we say we have to look to the canon that says you're going to give words that are due meaning. You're not going
to torture them into something.
A statute so that something is rendered negatory or without meaning. In fact, if we do take that very narrow definition, we are rendering meaningless or superfluous four terms. Four separate terms. We're rendering without meaning the phrase I described herein because it has no meaning. Because that's the only place it can be described herein is in the first sentence. We're also making superfluous offering health benefits within the meaning of this section and making health insurance available because read in context, the only place where they have meaning is referring back to the second sentence, provides health benefits. In fact, if we're going to impose that same canon religiously upon this text, then that means health benefits and health insurance have different meanings. Well, what meanings do they have? It's clear that the drafters were using health benefits and health insurance as synonyms of each other. They weren't meaning to signify something different by saying health benefits in the second sentence and health insurance in the third sentence.
And we know that how?
We know that by using the canon saying we harmonize all terms so that we don't have terms left that are superfluous. Had they had a different meaning for the term offering, it would have been defined somewhere. In fact, it says it's defined somewhere. It says it's defined as defined herein, and if the only place it's defined herein is if we refer to the above sentence because the term health insurance is not used anywhere else.
So how do we harmonize the two means of interpreting statutes that Justice Pickering points to and that you point to? And they are, if you excuse the term, mutually exclusive. We can't do both.
No, you can't do both. So we look at which canon of construction is more applicable and more powerful in this particular case. We know that the canon of common construction is a presumption, but it is easily overcome. In this particular case, it's overcome by the canon that says if we construe these as different terms, we're rendering superfluous three other terms or four other terms of the statute. And so the only way to get everything meaning is to say the drafters were using similar terms as synonyms. They use the term that provides health insurance and they use it to mean offering and making available, which is really going back to the beginning of the argument, is the definition of provide. Provide does not in and of itself inherently require an act of acceptance. And I'll use an example the respondents used in their brief. They used an example of NRCP 16.1, which we're all familiar with. It requires a party to provide initial disclosures to an opposing party. Well, if we're to impose that same restriction that there must be an act of acceptance on behalf of the other party or affirmative act to use that, then I as an attorney can put together my initial disclosures, I can put together the pleading that contains them, I can sign the pleading, I can put it in an envelope, I can address an envelope, and I can stamp it, and I can put it in the mail, and I still haven't provided my initial disclosures. Why? Because there's no affirmative act by the other party to accept those. They can land in his or her office, and they're still not accepted. Under their definition, those initial disclosures aren't provided until the person, the other party enrolls in them by opening up, you know, the open action and reading them. Provide does not entail, in and of itself, an affirmative act by the other party. It is to make available, to put within the reach of the party so they can choose to take it or not.
Can I ask you this?
Absolutely.
So if a worker chose not to take the provided benefits and enroll, then they would be subject to the lower tier wage, correct? And that seems contrary to the intent of the whole scheme of things. It was to cause an incentive for the employers to offer health insurance.
Well, I would step back saying, well, all we have is the language that the drafters provided for us. What we do know is they intended to raise the minimum wage, which they did. They tied the minimum wage, both tiers, to the Consumer Price Index. Okay, so, and they said the lower tier would never be below the federal minimum wage because it would be the greater of the federal minimum wage or the increases in the Consumer Price Index Urban. And so it's entitled raise the minimum wage and minimum wage compensation. It's not entitled, just provide everyone insurance.
Right.
So the way I look at it is the best way to bring into context all of these is say they wanted to raise the minimum wage and they wanted to give a break to an employer who was going to go through the exercise of going out and finding insurance and making it available for open enrollment and providing it to the employee. They weren't going to force the employee to take it, and they weren't going to force the employer to, against the employee's will, enroll them, because in real life, in health insurance has impact. It's an additional cost to the employee. Not all employees need it. Some employees have a spouse that has it. Some employees are covered by Medicaid. And the actual enrollment in another plan can impact that employee to their own detriment at times. And so the intent of the drafters was, let's give you an incentive here to employers. Number one, we're going to raise the minimum wage, which they did, without question. Number two, we're going to give an incentive to the employers to provide health insurance in the event that they have health plans that they want to make available to their employees. And that brings us to the fact that the Labor Commissioner, acting in the wake of the passing of the minimum wage amendment, decided to exercise with the acquiescence or the instructions of the Attorney General's office, determined that it was necessary to exercise his rulemaking authority at that time, and provided emergency regulations, temporary regulations, and permanent regulations. And in doing so, he went before the legislature, the Committee on Commerce and Labor, and discussed how he interpreted the minimum wage amendment, what it meant. And he discussed with them that he believed that the way it was drafted and that the employers were required to offer and make available health insurance, and the regulations reflect that. If you look at NRC 608.102, it's clear and unambiguous that what is required now is that the employer to pay the lower tier minimum wage offer or make available the health insurance. And then there's a mechanism to track those employees who do not opt to have the health insurance because it requires that the employer keep track of declinations. So the mechanism is in place. This is exactly what employers do that provide health insurance every day of the week, is they provide the health insurance during the periods of open enrollment. The employees choose to take the benefits or not. If they choose to do take the benefits, they enroll. So this was something that was actually in the common course of businesses that was going to be continued, and I don't see anything in the regulation number that changed what was going to happen here. Now, the one thing I would like to state is if the court were to choose to impose an enrolled requirement, this would cause some serious potential problems here. We view this as a change in the law. This would be actually a new law because the regulations, which have been in effect for 9 years and were never challenged until just recently, even in the wake of the minimum wage amendment, the drafter chose not to challenge them. Labor, which was behind the movement of the amendment, did chose not to challenge them. But if we were to now impose an enrolled obligation upon employers, that obligation should be only perspective because it's changing law, and in reality, in the court, as you well know, has an obligation if there's a change in law to weigh the retroactive effect against the prospective effect. In this particular case, because of 9 years of reliance upon duly passed and promulgated regulations, it would be a heavy burden on employers now to be automatically liable for 2, 3, or however many years we determine the statute of limitations is in this particular case.
Well, if you could, I'd like you to address your opponent's argument from the briefs, which offers a different view of that third sentence. As a sentence that is being used to describe the type and cost of insurance, health insurance, which I think would be an important separate consideration or parameter for any employer to know. It seems as though that performs a separate function in the constitutional amendment from the first distinction about providing insurance in order to be in the other tier. What do you say about that argument?
I appreciate the question. What I say is that in reality, the term in the previous sentence says provides health benefits, but there's no meaning behind what it means to provide health benefits. So the only place that we can define that is in the third sentence. And so in my view,
benefits could fluctuate considerably. What is the measuring stick is the cost of the health insurance. And isn't that an important consideration? Otherwise, the word provide could itself be completely illusory.
Well, in my view, that makes my exact point, because provides health benefits, we need to have some meat to describe what provides health benefits is. And this third sentence tells us what provides health benefits is. It's making benefits available to cover the employee and the employee's family, and are within 10%. That, to me, is the answer to the first question, and not a separate requirement. It's all one and the same as defining what we mean by provides health benefits. And if we were to describe it as anything else, we would render the phrase provides health benefits completely without meaning, because we don't know what it means to provide. And so we have to read those in tandem to come up with the meaning that the drafters intended.
Okay. Any questions? I think you're turning into your colleague's time.
Additional question has consideration of TIPS.
My colleague is going to address that right now, so I can see the floor to Mr. Davis.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Scott Davis from the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Labor Commissioner. A view of the minimum wage amendment that's presented by the Labor Commissioner through the regulations that were challenged in the Hancock portion of these consolidated cases is in fact the only reasonable view of the amendment, because it's the only view that follows this court's admonition to give meaning to each and every word and phrase in the constitutional text. Now, turning to the 10% cost cap that Your Honor just raised, NAC 608-104 achieves a harmonious reading of the minimum wage amendment, because it construes the phrase gross taxable income from the employer to effectively mean the equivalent amount of an employee's gross taxable wages as determined by the Internal Revenue Code. This doesn't present any conflict with the constitutional text, let alone the type of conflict that would be needed in order for this court to overturn codified regulations. It does give effect to every word and phrase within that clause. Gross taxable income has meaning. The regulations direct us to the only body of law that's capable of measuring an employee's taxable income, federal income tax law. The fact that tips are included is simply a function of federal tax law. But the tagline at the end, from the employer, that still retains meaning, because had that phrase not been included, a number of other sources of income that we count as gross taxable income that are unrelated to employment would be included in employees' gross taxable income, such as rents, alimony, and the like. Really quickly, the anti-tip crediting provision in the minimum wage amendment does not require that the rules for calculating gross taxable income be changed. Tip crediting refers to a practice under federal law under the Fair Labor Standards Act that allows an employer to pay an employee at a rate of $2.13 an hour plus tips to reach the federal minimum wage standard. The anti-tip crediting provision in the Minimum Wage Amendment says that that practice would not be allowed in Nevada. Under the Minimum Wage Amendment, the wage rate is going to be $7.25 or $8.25 an hour plus tips under the Minimum Wage Amendment. But that's a horse of a different color. It doesn't follow from that that calculating the 10% cost cap also has to exclude tips, especially in light of the Internal Revenue Code that includes tips. If there are no questions, I'd like to reserve what little time I have left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Your Honor, may it please the Court, good afternoon. My name is Bradley Schrager, and I'm counsel for all the other parties. This matter comes before you in a variety of procedural forms. But at bottom, what we're dealing with here is a statutory constitutional interpretation case. And in that, we have rules, we have canons, we have ways of determining what things mean. But as a prefatory comment, they've laid out their version of the language, we've laid out our version, and one of three things is true. Either we're right, they're right, or we're somehow right enough that the court wants to look or examine the language a bit beyond and look at things like context, logic, policy, and the public understanding of the Minimum Wage Amendment when it was enacted. Now, I will suggest to the court that we win two out of three of those. Number one, we win if we're right. And number two, we win if you accept that third premise, because the Minimum Wage Amendment is a remedial provision. This is an arguable. It has clearly intended benefits, a raise in wages or low-cost health insurance. It has clearly intended beneficiaries, my clients. We cannot interpret the Minimum Wage Amendment in a manner that denies these benefits from reaching the intended beneficiaries. And we're here today because my clients received nothing from the Minimum Wage Amendment. They got no raise. They got no health insurance. They got precisely zero in the 10 years since the minimum wage was enacted. Now, this court has stated again and again, remedial provisions with protective purposes and minimum wage amendments, if nothing else, are those, must be liberally construed to effectuate the benefits to be obtained. That goes back to IGT, goes back further to Colello, effectuate those benefits. Not made possible if you hold it up right to the light. Right? We are to interpret these provisions in a way that the promises of the amendment get to the beneficiaries. Now, if it's all right with the court, I'd like to start with the tip issue because I think it's the clearest of them, and it need not detain us very long because we submit on the plain language. Right? Premiums for employees and all their dependents cannot exceed 10% of the employee's gross taxable income from the employer. It says what it says. It doesn't say income earned in connection with the employment. It doesn't say but for being employed by the employer. The source of the income upon which we're calculating the 10% is clearly expressed and identified. It's the employer. It doesn't matter if it's gross taxable income, net income, adjusted gross income. I don't even care. It comes from the employer. Now this figure, the income from the employer, isn't just knowable. It's known every pay period to the employer. They know exactly what they have paid to their worker. It's reported to the IRS annually. This figure even has its own box on the W-2. It is not a mysterious figure, and it is the figure upon which the 10% is calculated. And it seems to me that the other side's argument is a rather long detour around the plain text, but I don't see that it actually arrives anywhere. They didn't really clinch what to do with the phrase from the employer, except to say that it doesn't mean from the employer. That's right out. But no one's arguing that tips, for example, are not income to the employee. Certainly they are. You'd be foolish to argue otherwise. What they are not is income from the employer.
Does that require an interpretation or definition of the word from, which, looking at different sources, is more expansive than just the employer. It could include an agency relationship. It could include an employer-employee relationship.
Well, it seems that what you're asking is, does it require a definition of employer as opposed to firm? Right? I mean, I went to dinner last night. I left a gratuity. That gratuity came from me. It didn't come from the employer. So if the question is, can firm mean something other than firm?
What if your employer requires tip pooling?
I don't think that matters. Because under Nevada law, those tips still don't belong to the employer. The employer can't keep those.
Correct.
Right? Those still make their way, even through a tip pooling arrangement, to the actual employee. You know, when you look at something like an order of garnishment, when wages are garnished in this state, and federally as well, now the employer handles that through the payroll process, but you can't garnish tips because they don't belong to the employer. They're not in the possession of the employer. Right? So garnishing is in the same way.
Well, but you kind of want to live by the sword and die by the sword here, because you're saying on the one hand, offering and provide necessarily mean two different things because they're two different words and they must have been used intentionally. You have the same problem with this argument, though, for you have wage defined quite clearly as the money that the employer pays the employee in another the adjacent section of the constitutional text. And yet, when you get to this 10%, it's income. And income seems broader than wage.
Sure.
You grant that. So how can you have the same rule of...
How do I square those? Now, I think, you know, when I say they never clinch from the employer, the closest I think they come is in one of the amicus briefs. I think it's the Landry's and Dottie's amicus brief. Well, what they're basically saying is, you're conflating income and wages. And if you look at the Nevada statutes on what wages are, 608.012, wages are the money paid by an employer for the employee's time. But it specifically excludes, for example, a bonus. Now, in the off chance that Wendy's of Las Vegas or some other party wanted to give bonuses to their employees, those aren't wages. But they are income from the employer, and they could be included. Right? So can income be broader than wages? Absolutely. It still has to come from the employer.
So you would add in bonus and distinguish wages from income in that way?
That would be one example of income from the employer that is not necessarily wages, but could be calculated in a 10% calculation because it still comes from the employer.
And on your tax form, it shows as wages.
Actually, what the tax form says is wages, tips, and I think bonus. I mean, I think there's a counter between them, but they are put together as far as what you pay taxes on. The employee or the employer still reports what they gave you.
Yeah, right? Okay.
So, I don't want to belabor the from the employer. It seems to me most people understand very quickly what they think this means. Nevada's not a tip credit state. It's not part of the minimum wage amendment. It's part of Nevada statute. No one has been. The Labor Commissioner doesn't get to create a tip credit by fiat or by regulation pertaining to the minimum wage amendment that would effectively double or triple insurance premium costs for the lowest paid workers in the state. So if we can, let's move on to the provide versus offering issue. Because whether an employer can merely offer health benefits is not as immediately apparent, I think, in the language. But I think a close and accurate reading of the minimum wage amendment still favors our position. And the first thing I want to say is that the drafters of the amendment could very easily have written the amendment in the way that exactly they are suggesting. It could have said, the rate shall be $7.25 per hour worked if the employer offers health benefits. That was a perfectly available set of words if they wanted to use those. They didn't do that. So immediately we know they at least didn't do that. They at least didn't mean offer, obviously so. So the best the other side can hope for, I think, is for this court to rule that they meant provide in the sense of merely offer, as opposed to what I think are provides other more common synonyms: furnish, bestow, transfer, supply, issue, impart, deliver, allot. All of those, the weight of the synonyms and the weight of the word provide involve a transfer, an exchange. So they're arguing that the NWA, the minimum wage amendment, it says provide, but somehow actually means only to offer. I think there's a lot working against that interpretation here, not least of which is the plain text and the construction of Section A of the amendment itself. Let's look at it. And I'll use the current numbers. The rate shall be $7.25 per hour worked if the employer provides health benefits as described herein, or $8.25 per hour if the employer does not provide such benefits. And the such benefits is absolutely key here. Because what benefits? The question that goes begging from that first sentence is not what is provide, it's what are the benefits.
You know, the very next sentence, though, I want you to explain to me, reads, offering health benefits within the meaning of this section shall consist of making health insurance available to the employee and the employee dependents at a total cost, on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So reconcile that for me.
Sure. Because to me, very helpfully, the sentence before that indicates benefits as described herein, going to describe the benefits, such benefits. Here come the benefits. This sentence describes and details such benefits. It describes them therein. This is the description therein, that very sentence. And it lays out three elements of what those benefits must be. They must be health insurance. Presumably, they must be lawful for the purpose of which they're offered, purchased, arranged for. They must be available to employees and all their dependents, whole family. Doesn't matter if there's one child or if there's 10. And it must observe the 10% rule. That's the meaning of that sentence.
Why didn't we just say give?
Or provide.
Instead of offering. And it seems to me that if the amendment were a model of clarity, we wouldn't be here today, and I'm sure you hear that all the time. But I think offering health benefits, this describes what an employer must arrange for, get, offer to an employee to even get to providing it. There cannot be enrollment. There cannot be someone getting insurance unless it's offered. Right? And you can offer one plan, you can offer five plans, you can offer 10 plans.
You can give one.
Well, the employee can accept, I guess, as many as they would pay for. Right? I don't know why they didn't.
If I give you something, it's different than if I offer
to
do something.
But is that different than providing? And council uses the phrase, okay, what if Clark County provides school buses, but your child is not? Okay, that's fair. But if Clark County says, we're going to provide you a school bus for $1, and I give you $1, you better take my kid to school. Right? There's savings there. So they stop short of really describing exactly what's going on there. Because you can't lose sight of it. These employees are giving up $1, which for 825 is a 12% reduction in their wages for the poorest workers among us. Right? So I think the function of the clause, Mr. Chief Justice, can't fairly be read as going back and changing the meaning of the word provide. The command still exists. If you want to pay $7.25 currently, you have to provide. This is what you have to offer to get to that step. But that sentence doesn't go back and change that. The employee in this context must have the thing promised by the amendment before the employer can reduce his or her wages. And that gets us to an important aspect of the context here, which is the Labor Commissioner and we, in our briefs, both agree there was a bargain inherent in the minimum wage amendment, a bargain between employers and employees. Where we differ, and this is the heart of the issue between us, is in the substance and meaning of that bargain. We say the bargain is fairly straightforward. You take the dollar, I get the insurance. If you don't take the dollar, you don't have to worry about insurance. If you do take the dollar, that's what I get back. That's the nature of a bargain. Everyone gets something. There's no something for nothing. There's an exchange. There's a transfer. That's the meaning of the amendment. That's the only way it can function. Labor Commission's version is that the bargain is more of an irrefusable option in which the employer always gets to take the dollar. What the employee gets, as long as they offer something, we haven't even talked about what they might have to offer, health insurance.
Well, and then as defined in this statute, the statute does define the minimum basement of what the employer must offer.
and the employee has a, your view would say that the employee need not have insurance and suffers then, the employee gets the choice of which wage the employee is paid and the full choice of whether to go uninsured or insured. And there's another argument as a matter of policy that this also reflects the desire to increase the number of insured people in Nevada, and therefore you don't want to incentivize that I'd take the extra dollar today rather than health insurance on the other side of that equation. I mean, it's not completely irrational. There's, you can see it both ways.
I mean, I think if we're looking at the incentives of the amendment, which was to raise wages or have employees, more families, you know, because it covers all the dependents, having comprehensive health insurance, because there really is no other kind if you're talking about health insurance, is that if the employer gets to take a dollar of your wages, but you don't get the insurance, you now have less money in your pocket, still need insurance. And in this day and age, under the Affordable Care Act, you have to go buy it on the exchange, or you're going to be paying more money in tax to the Internal Revenue Service. And it seems to me what the Labor Commissioner is saying is that the employer controls all, right? All the employee gets is the chance to offer whatever benefits plan the employer puts before him or her. Now, the employer already controls whether you get to work for them at all, gets to control your working hours, the schedule within those hours. Now, this is a bit much. It, you know, now also selects the benefits plan to which employees' wages are tied no matter whether they accept it or they don't. Now, just from an enforcement standpoint or a common sense standpoint, there are many ways in which an employer could discourage acceptance or enrollment in particular plans. Right? There are ways to control the offer. There are ways by offering what I refer to as junk insurance.
That's not an issue here.
Correct. What I'm talking about are ways in which that could affect.
You're just talking about policy.
Sure. Indeed. What I'm talking about is that the Labor Commissioner's version is not a bargain, right? And it's certainly not within the minimum wage amendment envisioned. In this instance, it is worse than a contract of adhesion, because at least in a contract of adhesion, the other party can take it or leave it. What they're saying is the employee can't leave it once the employer decides they've already taken it, whether they get the insurance or not. Now, a proper interpretation of the minimum wage amendment cannot leave my clients with nothing, with no raise and no health insurance, while creating what is basically a windfall for the employer. So, the way I laid it out, a ruling for the other side in their favor on this particular point renders the MWA a dead letter, because we cannot get the benefits of the amendment to the people for whom it was intended. Now, if I can move briefly to retroactivity, because it was raised earlier, it's also raised in the summary of the argument today. Well, the general rule regarding retroactivity, the presumption is that judicial decisions apply retroactively. I think that's especially important when you're talking about a constitution and interpreting constitutional rights. And so it has to do with what this court does, what its role and authority and power is when it makes those decisions, when it makes those pronouncements. If the court decides that we're right, it's because we've always been right. This is just the first chance for us to stand up and talk with you about it. Law hasn't changed. Right? You'll be saying not what the law is from now on, but what it was from the moment of enactment going forward. Beyond that, the existence of these particular regulations, which, I mean, we're here in part because the First Judicial District Court said these regulations are invalid, that the Labor Commissioner at the time, right, exceeded his authority, and that they don't meet the requirements of the minimum wage amendment. Now, the literature on administrative law is rife with concern over and notions of agency capture. And by that I mean, obviously, influence upon the political branches. It seems to me that perspective-only ruling here sends a signal that that's an incredibly worthwhile exercise on the part of those who can exercise it. Because if you get an agency to write favorable regulations, you'll have a get-out-of-liability card for as long as no one notices, and no one like me gets up and does anything about That might be a different case, or this might be a different case, if the regulations in question just somehow slightly skewed the expected function of the minimum wage amendment. What we're talking about here are regulations that flipped it on its head, that thwarted demonstrably the purposes of the amendment, resulting in the exact opposite of what was supposed to occur. And lastly, what you look at when you think about retroactivity or prospectivity are the equities. Now, a prospective-only ruling here would allow the defendants in the cases below to keep an unlawfully derived benefit for 10 years. 10 years for every hour worked for these employees. It would seem to me that a 4-year statute of limitations addresses the equities quite sufficiently in that regard. But we also need to look at the equities from my client's perspective, who gave up an awful lot of money, which in real life should have been in their pocket all along. Now, at least in the case of the tip issue, I don't think there's any question of prospectivity only. I think that, as we know in the briefs, there's an actual regulation standing next to the only challenge in which the labor commissioner is directing employers how to calculate the 10%.
Go ahead, please.
And it says, first start with the amount of wages or income paid by the employer. It says paid by the employer. So it's not as if respondents or petitioners can stand before you and say, we're just doing what the labor commissioner told us to do. What they did was follow a particular regulation that suited them and ignore one that was quite the opposite, that was operating properly. So, and there's certainly no record that that was ever challenged. There was no declaratory relief saying we don't understand what to do here. Right. So in that regard, retroactivity, absolutely the rule. I think the same is true under all the factors we've talked about of the providing versus offer issue. And with that, I'll submit, Your
Honor. Okay. Colleagues, any questions? No? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schrager. Appreciate your presentation.
Thank you, Your Honor. The blueprint for deciding this case is this court's precedent in Cook v. Mayer. That case says when you're interpreting the Constitution, you don't balance the equities to try and reach what you perceive to be a fair result. You follow the constitutional text. And if this court does that on either of the issues that have come up in these cases, the labor commissioner's position expressed in the regulation must prevail. Turning really quickly back to the 10% cost cap, we've heard a lot about what it means to be from the employer. But the problem with that is that it's being emphasized to such a degree in this case that it's at the expense of the gross taxable income language. The labor commissioner's interpretation achieves a balanced view. This court doesn't need to sacrifice the gross taxable income requirement. Under the Internal Revenue Code, wages are the income that comes from the employer, and wages is specifically defined in the Internal Revenue Code to include tips. Turning real quickly to the other issue about the meaning of provides.
But that gets to a question I posed to Mr. Schrager. The tips don't come from the employer, unless you define the word from to include them being tips being part of the source or the reason that the tips are paid is because they work for the employer. But from is not addressed in your regulations as a separate defined term, is it?
It's addressed to the extent that the regulations refer to income attributable to the employer, and certainly attributable to the employer and from the employer doesn't entail such a degree of deference that would justify upsetting the administrative regulation. When you look at that in a context, in its plain meaning, if you just read it through and give it its common sense interpretation, gross taxable income from the employer is not different than the amount of taxable wages under the Internal Revenue Code. There's not that difference there.
So you're looking at the Administrative Code 6.1042.
Correct.
For that definition.
If the court would like me to address the other issue of minimum provides, I will. Otherwise, my time is up.
Colleagues, any questions? All right. Thank you. I think we're done. And appreciate the presentations today. It's an interesting case. This will stand submitted.